The big demonstrations show that people are very, very wound up. I mean, you know, the Iraq War was one of the biggest political crises since the Second World War in British society. And, you know, so the idea that people don't care about these things, it really isn't true. It's a myth. We need to build a movement in this country that is really about challenging not just the foreign policy, but also the neoliberal economics that underpin it.
Welcome to The Big Picture, a show about the past, the present, and the future. My name is Mohammed Hassan, and today we sit down with British political activist, author, and the deputy chair of the Stop the War Coalition, Chris Nynam. Nynam has for decades been on the front lines of anti-war demonstrations in the UK, working alongside figures such as Jeremy Corbyn and Tariq Ali. He was instrumental in organizing the historic march against the invasion of Iraq in 2003, often dubbed the biggest protest in UK history. The ill-fated invasion and the UK's deeply unpopular role in it would help bring about the end of Prime Minister Tony Blair's career, something that Nynam wrote a book about, The People versus Tony Blair. Most recently, he and the Stop the War Coalition have been helping organize the large ceasefire rallies in London and other cities, which have swelled in number as Israel's disastrous war in Gaza continues, drawing hundreds of thousands to the streets every week. On January 13th, just days from now, they're planning on holding their biggest rally yet, a global call to action, hoping to pressure British and other Western officials into forcing Israel to end its war. Will it work? And is protesting an effective way for change? Chris Nynam, it's a pleasure to have you with us today. Welcome to The Big Picture.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Let's begin by talking about the global action that is being organized for the 13th of January, 2024 now. It's a new year, but the action that has been ongoing over the last 3 months here in London and other cities around the world, this is planned to possibly be the biggest one. What are you expecting to happen on the day?
Well, we're definitely expecting it's going to be a very big demonstration in London. It's a national demonstration, and we're calling on people from around the country to make sure that they do everything possible to get down here. I mean, I think the national demonstrations are very, very important because they express, they visualise, they show the extent and breadth and depth of feeling that people have over this issue. And, you know, the local demonstrations are also very important in terms of building the movement and drawing more people into the organisation of the movement. But the national demonstrations are when we make a statement to the political classes, to the establishment, to the British state, that the people of this country are not happy with what is being done in our name. And therefore they have I understand it's quite difficult for people to keep coming down to London, but it's super important precisely for that reason. I don't know if it'll be the biggest, but it'll definitely be one of the bigger of the demonstrations because we haven't been out on the streets in London on a national demonstration now for a number of weeks. And I think people are wanting to get back to it. So that's the importance of it nationally. I think it's also important to say this is, for the first time, a day of global action. It's part of a day of global protest that actually the coalition in this country has been calling for. And we're very happy that so far, I think there's towns and cities in 28 countries that have signed up and have said that they're going to be marching on the 13th or some of them on the 14th. In order to be part of this global day. And that's important because I think partly it's just inspirational to people in the individual countries concerned because you feel part of something broader. But in a material sense, I think if we can move in the direction of a coordinated global international movement with people coming out on the streets on the same day, the kind of the movement sort of unfolding as the day rolls on, starting in Australia, going right through Asia, you know, into Europe and then into the America. It's a very powerful thing. And I think it will send a message, not just to the Israelis, but also to the Western powers that are backing them, that, you know, the dynamic is going away from them, that the flow of opinion is in our direction, and that they're becoming more and more isolated. And so I think this is going to be a very important day, and hopefully it'll be the launch of a growing international coordinated movement that we can sort of push ahead with afterwards.
You're coordinating with other groups, maybe similar groups in different countries. What does that communication look like? What do those conversations look like?
Well, I mean, it's rudimentary at the moment. You know, it's up to now, it's been quite, it's been kind of just, you know, initial contact, I'd say. We want to firm that up. We are moving in the direction of hopefully having some meetings and discussions and you know, putting plans in place more seriously. And where we want to get to is to, you know, massively increase the number of countries that are on board. I mean, it's great that there are some places in the global south that are demonstrating already, but we'd like to have more protests in the Middle East, coordinate with the Middle East itself. So there's lots of work to be done. Hopefully, if this is a success, which I believe it will be, we can ramp things up quite dramatically from the day after the demonstration.
And what is the message that you are hoping to send here to the British administration, but in other countries as well, to their respective governments, about what is happening in Gaza and what kind of stance that you want them to take about it?
Well, I mean, at one level, the message is kind of, it's visceral, it's emotional, it's just a sense of outrage and an incomprehension, to be honest, I think, that our political class, the British establishment, could, right across the board, with the exception of, you know, 50 or so MPs, could be standing aside and not calling for a ceasefire in the face of this level of barbarity, in the face of these images that we're all having to witness of, you know, almost unbearable horror that is being caused, that is being generated by what the Israelis are doing. So, I mean, there's a sense in which they're very emotional demonstrations, and they're angry in a certain sense, although there is also, I think anyone who's been on them will agree, there is also a sense of relief, really, that actually, you know, you realise when you're on the demonstrations that you're not alone. You realise that there are huge numbers of people who share your sense of outrage and share your sense of anger. But politically, what we are trying to do is essentially twofold. One is send solidarity to the people of Palestine and make a protest against what the Israelis are doing that they themselves will hopefully have to register. But two, we aim the demonstration and the whole movement at the British government, because the most important thing that we can do to show solidarity for the Palestinian people in this country is ultimately to break the British government's and the British political establishment's support for what Israel is doing and for the whole enterprise of the Israeli state. And, you know, that's a very, very important thing, because, I mean, some of the Labour MPs have been saying that, you know, what the opposition in Britain does or what the British government's attitude to Israel is not that important. Mm. They're completely wrong. This is a myth, I guess, deliberately designed to make us feel like what we're doing isn't important or powerless. But the fact of the matter is, it does matter a lot what the attitude of the British government is to the Israeli state. It does matter a lot what the attitude of the Labour leadership and the Labour Party is to this question, because Britain is the most loyal, very junior, but nevertheless most loyal partner of the US in global politics. And US support for Israel is absolutely key, not just to the continuation of these horrible attacks on Gaza, but to the continuation of the Israeli state itself. Mm. So, you know, if we were able to break the British government from their support for Israel, it would have huge repercussions all around the world. So I think the British movement is very, very strategically important. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to create a situation ultimately where it is impossible for them to continue to, to collude really in what is going on in Gaza and in the West Bank.
Since October 7th, and there has been weekly protests taking place in London, other cities around the world, other cities in the UK. Apart from that, there's also been, you know, 3 to 4 actions that take place locally every week. And, you know, the only exception maybe is the Christmas break. And then this is the first national march mobilization that's taking place in the new year. And it's almost been 3 months. And what impact do you think that has had on the government and its positions? On the surface, it seems like it hasn't really had an impact on the way that the government has decided to continue its foreign policy position of supporting Israel. We've now seen this kind of somewhat middle ground of a so-called sustainable ceasefire that the government has now taken, but in effect, it hasn't really shifted its position. Why do you think that is? And do you think the protests have budged that position in any direction?
Well, obviously, it's very frustrating that, you know, it's still the case that the British government and the rest of them, the Labour leadership and so on, are still refusing to call for a ceasefire, essentially supporting in a sort of slightly critical way what the Israelis are doing. I mean, it's deeply frustrating and it's shameful. But at the same time, I think it's important to recognise that the demonstrations are making a difference. We've got a situation where, you know, the government tried to move against the movement and say that we couldn't march on November the 11th. We defied the ban. In the process of defying the ban, we created really quite a serious political crisis in the British establishment. Not only was a Home Secretary, one of the most toxic Home Secretaries this country has ever had, not only was she removed from office, but there was this moment where the police and the Home Office were at loggerheads. The police and the government were arguing publicly, which is a very un-English thing, actually. It's not the way politics is normally conducted in Britain. This was a product of a huge mass movement, a mobilisation that the police themselves recognised they couldn't stop, but yet the government was trying to force them to. So it was a moment of crisis, which I think shows that, you know, the establishment has been rocked by this issue. Now, on top of that, we've got a situation where the Welsh Assembly, the Scottish Assembly, the Liberal Democrats have all had to come out in favour of a ceasefire. Mm-hmm. And where there is now turmoil, really, in the Labour Party, the main opposition party. You know, there was a significant rebellion, almost as big in percentage terms as the rebellion over Iraq. But also lots of people resigning from Labour, resigning the whip. Lots of councillors starting to say, you know, they're not going to put up with this anymore. They're not going to go along with this. So I think we have. It's not enough. And it's terrible that we haven't been able to actually change the official position. But we are making inroads. We are having an impact. Mm. And, you know, I think it's absolutely crucial to hold on to that. I think the reason you ask, why is it that the British establishment is being so obstinate? Why are they still continuing to defend the indefensible? Why are they still continuing to refuse to call for a ceasefire? The reason is because the British establishment is very, very close to America. It's, you know, a big, obviously, very, very tightly linked in foreign policy terms. And both of those governments believe that support for Israel is absolutely essential for their foreign policy aims. Mm. Really, for them, Israel is crucial. The reason that the US gives so much funding, it gives more funding to Israel than any other state on the planet. Why is that? It's because they use Israel, they need Israel to continue to secure their interests in the Middle East, which is an important area for them, mainly because of the oil and gas. It's as cynical and as simple and horrible as that. And that's the reason why they're continuing to take this attitude and they're continuing to take this position. So, you know, that's why breaking them would be so important, but it's also why it's quite a difficult job. It's quite a task.
Yeah, and you spoke recently at the Home Affairs Select Committee, and one of the things that you said was that there was a deep democratic deficit in the UK over the ability for British citizens to question and influence the foreign affairs policies of the country. Can you talk about that?
Well, I mean, this is something we've been grappling with now for decades, really. You know, Britain regards itself as being an important global player. The British government wants to be running this policy they call Global Britain. They want to have a strong military. They have more direct foreign investment than any other country in Europe, in various different countries around the world. They want to back that up and defend their interests with military power. And, you know, they do this in the most brutal way. And what's happened since really the Iraq invasion is that the British population, the majority of people in Britain, have kind of taken against this policy, have turned against this interventionist, militarised foreign policy in a big way in general. And so you've got this huge tension, really, over foreign policy in British society, which you saw around Afghanistan, you saw around Iraq, reached a peak over Iraq, led to the demise of Blair, really, the political demise of Blair. And then, funnily enough, I think was quite key in Corbyn's achievement of taking the Labour leadership in 2016. Because, you know, I think there's no way that he would have become the leader of the Labour Party if he hadn't been on the big demonstrations over Iraq in 2003 and hadn't been quite prominent in that. So I think there's an ongoing kind of political contest in Britain between the elites who really think that it's important to spend lots of money on nuclear weapons and lots of money on troops and lots of money on warships and so on, and really pursue their commercial interests around the globe in tight association with the US. And the majority of people who would rather see the money spent on the NHS or on decent wages for public sector workers or on welfare or, you know, a whole number of different things. And this is, in a sense, one of the absolutely central kind of fault lines in British politics. And you're seeing that play out once more over the question of Palestine. I mean, it's a funny thing, really. And you know, maybe a bit unexpected, but the two biggest demonstrations in British history have both happened in the last 20 years. One was over Iraq and one was on November the 11th recently over Palestine. So foreign policy is a very, very important issue in British politics. And some people on the left, particularly in the Labour Party, like to downplay it and like to suggest that, you know, most ordinary people, so-called, are really just interested in bread and butter politics. They're interested in, you know, the question of housing or whatever, or wages or welfare or cuts and so on and so forth. But actually, people in reality, people understand that these things can't be disassociated. You can't talk about domestic policy in Britain without talking about foreign policy, really, because, you know, we are historically such a huge colonial power. We have such a history of intervention around the world. And, you know, I think a lot of people understand that every penny or every pound spent on arming Israel or spent on fighting, on arming the Ukrainians or on nuclear weapons in this country is a pound not spent on education. It's a pound not spent on the NHS. It's a pound not spent on the wages that people so badly need, in wage increases people so badly need at a time of inflation and cost of living crisis. So the things are connected, and we have to make sure that people understand. I mean, we have to on the left, we have to make sure that we reflect that fact.
We are in campaign mode right now. We're in an election year. We're possibly, you know, 4 to 6 months at least away from a general election in this country. And this issue of the war in Gaza, of Britain's position, of the ceasefire, is a big issue. And it's something that is, you know, the government's position has been quite unpopular with regards to public opinion in this country. And yet you're seeing almost kind of across the board between the Conservatives and Labour a unanimous position of moving forward with that and not really kind of backtracking on that position. Do you think that in the minds of these two major parties that, as you were saying, that this is not going to have an impact on the election this year and that people are a lot more vested in the economic conditions in the UK than they are about what Britain does or what it, you know, supports overseas?
No, I think it will have an impact. I definitely think it will. I mean, it's hard to predict exactly. But, I mean, you know, I think there'll be a lot of people who don't vote. And one of the reasons they won't vote is because they feel outraged at the fact that both the main parties have supported Israel or have failed to criticise Israel in this situation. I think that it's difficult because, you know, there isn't an obvious party to vote for who are against the militarism, against the wars, against what Israel is doing, pro-Palestine. So it's going to create a big problem, I think, for lots of people coming up to the election. I think there will be some candidates in some areas who are who do take a principled position, both people inside the Labour Party, some people in the Green Party, and also I think there'll be some independent. Well, obviously, there's going to be some independents standing. I think Jeremy Corbyn will stand. I think various other independents will stand on a you know, anti-war and essentially pro-ceasefire ticket. Mm. So that will provide an opportunity for people in some places to have a positive vote. But so in that sense, I think it's going to play out in quite a complicated way. And it will start the process of, I think, of reshaping British politics, really. And there's definitely lots of talk now. Let's see if it comes to anything. But there's a good deal of talk and a good deal of discussion about, you know, new political formations that can reflect some of these ideas, that can reflect the widespread feeling that we shouldn't be involved in these foreign wars, we shouldn't be supporting Israel, we shouldn't be arming Ukraine to the teeth, we shouldn't be risking the possibility of wider wars in either in Eastern Europe or in the Middle East, and that we should actually be pumping the money into the things that ordinary people need. So, you know, I can see the beginnings of some quite deep shifts in British politics over the next 6 months or a year. How quickly those things move, it's very hard to tell. Mm. What the exact process is, it's impossible to predict. But I think things are starting to shift.
Mm. You mentioned Jeremy Corbyn as well, and that, you know, we go back to the last election, and there was a lot in the way that Corbyn and the Labour Party under him presented itself as being kind of anti-foreign intervention, anti-imperialist in the way that, you know, trying to reject Britain's history of imperialism and the kind of the modern day impacts of that. And following the almost kind of purge of Corbynism from the party after he was ejected, there was a sense that all of these things were irrelevant to the way that the Labour Party presented itself and that it had to kind of go back to what things were like under Tony Blair, which is like, you know, this reforming of the economy and reforming its relationship to the government, going after the centrist vote a lot more. That is a strategy that, at least in the minds of someone like Sir Keir Starmer, is the best way to go into an election and to kind of return the Labour government to power. Do you think that's a mistake, letting go of the foreign policy aspect of how the Labour Party presents itself?
Well, I think in general it's a mistake because I don't believe that the essential problem for the left is that, you know, it's perceived as being too radical or too committed to change and idealistic. I just don't think that's not the essential problem. Really, the problem is that I think there's a widespread feeling that Westminster politics doesn't really reflect people's concerns, that, you know, it doesn't deliver for ordinary people, that it's, you know, a bunch of fairly elite individuals, many of whom are really quite rich, who are, you know, have their own ambitions and are feathering their own nests, really. I think that's much more what people feel about Westminster politics, that it's not, it's out of touch. And the way that the left should or could try and regain the initiative would actually be by being more anti-establishment, by being, you know, more kind of radical and saying that we want to shake things up here. We want to address some of the essential problems that people feel, which is, you know, the housing crisis, the terrible low pay, you know, terrible kind of gig economy, the state of education, the state of schools, the cost of living crisis, all of these things. They need to be addressed and they need to be confronted, really. And I think it's only when they are that people will start to wake up and say, OK, something's happening in Westminster, because at the moment it's a big turnoff. I suspect the turnout at the election will be pretty low. I guess a lot of people will vote just because they want to get rid of the Tories, but no one's got any enthusiasm for this centrist project of Starmerism. It just looks grey, it looks dull, and it looks pretty much like an echo of what the Tories are doing. That's really the truth. And who's that going to inspire? If people want to vote for Tory policies, they're going to vote for the real thing. They're not going to vote for a kind of pale imitation. Mm. So I think more radicalism, more imagination, more of a kind of, you know, an approach which is sort of breaking with the consensus would actually be, even in electoral terms, would be more effective. And that includes the question of foreign policy. Because, as I say, there's this kind of, you know, there is this deeply felt kind of attitude in the parts of the left, and certainly in the sort of mainstream of the Labour Party, that, you know, foreign policy is not something people really care about very much. Mm. And that if they do, they don't like the kind of Corbyn approach. They don't like the radical anti-militarism that he represented. The truth is, there's not a lot of evidence for that. Mm. The big demonstrations show that people are very, very wound up. I mean, you know, the Iraq War was one of the biggest political crises since the Second World War in British society. And, you know, so the idea that people don't care about these things, it really isn't true. It's a myth. So I think, yeah, I mean, any serious left, any serious Labour Party that actually wanted to try and address the fundamental issues in British society and build popular appeal would actually say that the kind of foreign policy we've been involved in for the last 25 years has been a disaster. It's been a disaster for the people in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Syria, in Libya, in lots of other places. But also it's been a disaster for us, because it's made the world a more dangerous place. Billions and billions and billions of pounds have been wasted on weapons of mass destruction, which have been exported to various different corners of the world and have just done nothing other than creating misery and carnage. You know, what's to like about this? So I think we shouldn't shy away from these questions. We should put them front and centre of our political approach, really.
Friends, we are here today to show Tony Blair and to tell him openly that if one country needs a regime change at the moment, it's Britain.
If war does break out, we should turn around and say that we're prepared to occupy our industries and not be prepared to allow for a war to take place anywhere throughout the world.
Our message today here in London, a million and more strong, is this. We want to live in a world free from war. The way to free us from the scourge of war is to free ourselves from the scourge of injustice, of poverty, and the misery that's associated with that.
Let's go back to the Iraq War and the Iraq War demonstration 2003 and the Stop the War Coalition that had, you know, at that point been formed 2 years earlier in the wake of the invasion of Afghanistan that the UK was a part of. What was the climate like in the UK? What was the climate like in the circles that you were part of in terms of, you know, thinking that let's organize something that is big, that is part of a global action, that can have an impact on the way that this government looks at foreign policy, the way that it, you know, handles itself abroad?
Well, I mean, immediately after 9/11, as always in those situations, you really don't know what is going on in people's minds. You don't know what's going on under the surface. That's the reality. And we took a gamble that people were going to respond to the attacks, the horrible attacks on New York and Washington, by saying, look, we shouldn't retaliate. We shouldn't respond in kind. People had a sense that George Bush and possibly Tony Blair were going to use this this attack as an excuse for doing bad things and doing dangerous things. And that's exactly what happened. But I mean, even we were, I guess, taken somewhat by surprise by the response we got, because we called a meeting, I don't know, 8 or 9 days after 9/11 in 2001. And 3,000 or 4,000 people turned up. I think it was Stop the War Before It Starts or something was the kind of title of the meeting. And it was absolutely huge. We had to have people out. We had people queuing outside. We had 3 meetings in the hall and 1 in the complex and a big meeting outside the hall as well. It was obvious that the concerns that that we had were shared by many, many people. That that you know the West was gonna make big mistakes and was gonna plunge us all into possible foreign interventions, and that's obviously what happened. But I mean, the opposition mushroomed fairly quickly because we did put together a big coalition. We built the broadest coalition we could, not just of the left, but trade unions, people from the churches, people from the mosques. We reached out to as many communities as we possibly could and said, let's stand together. Mm. Let's keep it simple. Don't attack Iraq. Freedom for Palestine, you know, etc. No to attacks on civil liberties, these kinds of things. Few simple slogans, and let's unite around them and really try and build a movement. Mm. And a lot of people thought, oh, what are you doing? You know, this isn't going to wash. But actually, it grew and grew. We spent a year building it up to the invasion of Iraq, and by the end of that year, just over a year, we had, as you know, between 1 million and 2 million people out in the streets, which was is completely unprecedented in British history, you know, particularly on the question of foreign policy. Yeah. And you know, it's a game changer, really. We didn't stop the Iraq war, but I think the movement, the broad movement, has and did manage to kickstart a debate in British society about where we were heading with this country and with our foreign policy, and what kind of priorities did we want to see in the running of our government and our society more generally. And that's a debate that's continued right through the last 2 decades. As I say, I think Corbynism was partly, and in fact largely, an expression of that debate. Mm. And I think it continues to this day. And I think it's been a very important movement for all of those reasons.
And I mean, Corbyn is also, you know, somebody that had come from the Stop the War Coalition, that also come from the Palestine Solidarity Movement. This was really somebody from your own ranks that had at one point become, or was about to become, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. What impact do you think that kind of says about what you guys had built over the course of those 2 decades?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, it was, in a weird way, the Corbyn moment was a kind of social movement insurgency into the ranks of the Labour Party. And I think that tells you quite a lot about how politics works, actually. And that, you know, the importance and the potential impact that mass movements can have when they reach this kind of scale. You know, people say, oh, we marched and it made no difference. Actually, we didn't stop the war in Iraq. We haven't completely changed foreign policy. But I think what happened in the Labour Party shows that it's simply not true to say that the movement had no impact. And in fact, it has helped to shape the way foreign policy is conducted, despite everything. The truth is, and the generals and people from the MOD moan about this in private, really, they are not able anymore to do an Iraq. They couldn't send 35,000, 40,000 troops into a foreign country and invade it like they did in 2003, Because, and the reason they couldn't is because they know that there would be these massive protests. There'd be a kind of social revolt again. So I think it has had an inhibiting effect, even if it hasn't completely transformed the situation. We need to take it forward from there, but I think there's no question. The other thing that's very significant here is the response of the British establishment. The fact that the right in the Labour Party, in association with the kind of networks around Blair and Mandelson, in association with sections of the media, even, you know, parts of the rest of the state machine in Britain, colluded to systematically destroy the Corbyn project in such a kind of ruthless and organised way, tells you how frightened they were by it. It tells you how serious the threat was, but it also tells you how committed the British state is, the British establishment is, to continuing its kind of militarist, aggressive foreign policy. You know, this is not an optional extra for the British government or the British state. This is central to the whole way it understands itself and the whole way it projects itself around the globe and to its economic policy, global Britain. You know, this is really, really central. So in some ways, it's not surprising that we haven't completely changed the situation, but we have threatened them. We have changed the climate of opinion anyway in British society. And so I think it's the battle continues.
And that protest movement in 2003 and those historic protests, as you mentioned, you know, didn't prevent the Iraq War from happening, but in the years following became such a huge burden on the Blair government that ultimately, you know, the government and Tony Blair himself had to kind of publicly be held accountable for what happened during that period of time. You wrote a book about this. I'm curious to hear what you think this, the impact of this movement that has built around this idea of a ceasefire in Gaza, that so far, you know, has not been able to achieve its aims of stopping the war in Gaza. What kind of impact do you think it could have here in the UK, but elsewhere as well?
Well, the one thing I'd say is that don't underestimate the extent of the crisis that was generated by the Iraq War and the resistance to it back in 2003-2004. And I did look into it a little bit for the book that I wrote about Blair. And it's very, very interesting. I mean, we didn't realise at the time just how vulnerable they felt, just how close to the edge they were. I mean, you know, insider accounts that have been published since show that Blair was a number of times in the run-up to the Iraq War, he really thought that he was finished. He thought that there would be a rebellion in Labour that would finish him off. There's the famous episode where I think just 8 days before the Iraq War started, Jeff Hoon, who was the Defence Secretary, phoned Donald Rumsfeld in America and said, I don't think we're going to be able to participate in this war. And in a very humiliating exchange, sort of Rumsfeld apparently just kind of shrugged his shoulders and went, okay, well, so be it, you know. But actually, if we had managed to stop British participation, it wouldn't have had so much a huge impact on the military side of things, but it would have had a huge impact on America's ability to project itself as having a kind of coalition around it. So I think there was a very deep crisis that was generated by the anti-war movement at that point. And I mean, you know, I'm not saying we've reached that level yet over Palestine, but nevertheless, don't believe that this this situation is just going to be, you know, smoothly resolved for the British establishment. I think there's a certain cumulative impact here that people were sickened by Iraq, by Libya, by Syria. they may be a bit confused by what happened to Ukraine, but once again now people are saying, you know, what are these people doing? What is their game here? What is their priority? I think there's a deep sense of cynicism about the steps being taken here, because the gap between the reality of what the politicians are saying and what people are seeing on their feeds and their social media on TV is so great that there's a kind of, I think, a credibility problem, a legitimacy problem developing for the elites here. And I'm not sure that they'll be able to come back from that. I'm sure they won't be able to come back from it unscathed. I mean, and I think to a certain extent, people are seeing the rest of politics through the prism of what's happening in Palestine. And I thought at the end of last year, when the pandemic inquiry was going on, and when you had that moment where Boris Johnson had to admit to saying, let the bodies pile high, I thought that was kind of an interesting moment in a horrible way, because it against the background of the bodies literally piling high in the Gaza Strip, you could see people thinking, oh my God, you know, they really don't care about us. You know, they really, you know, they don't care about us here. They don't care about Palestinians. Human life for them is nothing. And, you know, in the pursuit of profits in one form or another, they're prepared to sacrifice people. And I don't think that any government or any regime can kind of go through that process of popular thinking without suffering some serious collateral damage.
And the Labour Party under Sir Keir Starmer has been going through a, you know, very public transformation over the last couple of years since 2019. And part of that transformation has been the reintroduction of Blairism and the language of Blairism, and this idea that, you know, the party needs to go back to its glory days in the 90s and the 2000s, when it held the public consensus and had public respect and admiration. And, you know, Tony Blair himself has been reintroduced into that very publicly. There are high-profile meetings between him and Sir Keir Starmer. Sir Keir Starmer has thanked him publicly for being a sort of mentor to him. And then, you know, even more recently, there's been talk about Tony Blair coming back as a kind of post-Gaza war advisor or negotiator. And I'm curious, as somebody that, you know, who has a kind of personal relationship with Blairism and what that period of time meant, what you think about that and what you think about the direction that the Labour Party is heading in.
Well, I mean, partly I think the process of repetition creates problems for them in itself. You know, there's a certain way in which it's first time tragedy, second time fast, really. Because for people of a certain age, you know, we've been there before and we saw what it was like, and it wasn't pleasant, not just in terms of foreign policy, but really I think a lot of people now recognise that what Blairism was about was kind of importing free market ideas into, you know, really quite, you know, radical free market ideas and privatisation and so on into the heart of the Labour Party. And Margaret Thatcher famously said, when asked what was her greatest contribution to politics, she said Tony Blair. And, you know, and what she meant by that was that, you know, they managed to, the ideologues of neoliberalism and the free market managed to actually co-opt the Labour Party and therefore win a kind of political consensus. So those, as I say, people who went through and lived through those years, I think will be quite sceptical anyway about what going back to that means. And largely because of the Iraq War, which was the single, by far the biggest kind of negative legacy of the Blair years. But I don't think it's just that. I also think that, you know, I mean, Tony Blair had a bit of charisma. He had a bit of drive. He had some ideas. He was able to dress up his kind of his essentially pro-market politics in a kind of socially progressive, you know, slightly kind of woke set of identitarian ideas. I mean, Keir Starmer just hasn't got that kind of nous, you know, and he hasn't got that ability really. So plus, he's operating and this is crucial, actually, Keir Starmer will be operating, is functioning at the moment in a much, much harsher economic climate. Blair benefited from a short economic boom, fairly shallow economic boom, but nevertheless a real one, which gave him some room to manoeuvre. That's not going to happen. You know, ever since the banking crisis in 2008, we've been in, you know, we've been flatlining, basically. The British economy has been flatlining, or worse. And there's no signs of that situation changing. So, you know, we're really going to be talking about a government of austerity with a very bland, you know, figurehead who's got no ideas and no connection with ordinary people. So, you know, I think it's disastrous, really. I think it's catastrophic. And I don't, although I think Labour probably will win the election, I don't think they'll win it with any sense of enthusiasm. And there was actually genuinely a sense of enthusiasm in 97 for a bit, because there was a feeling that this was something different, this was something dynamic. It's not going to be like that. At best, there'll be a sense of relief that the Tories are finally gone. But I don't think anyone's going to think, OK, Keir Starmer's going to come in and sort things out for us.
And, I mean, the Labour Party has been, in recent weeks, trying to almost massage some of the public image that it's lost as a result of the Gaza war. Keir Starmer's talked about tackling Islamophobia as an example. And there is generally a perception that it's harder to protest against the Labour government than it is to protest against the Conservative government, especially if the protests are coming from the left. Do you think that's going to be the case once Labour gets into power? Do you think it's going to take some air out of the movement that's been ongoing?
I mean, definitely not for long, if at all. And in a certain sense, I'm not sure you're right that it's always harder to do protests under a Labour government. I mean, you know, because When you have a Conservative government, the argument can be put, well, let's just get rid of them, let's, you know, wait till the election, we'll get a better government. When Labour wins, then that option, that safety valve, is no longer going to be there. So when Starmer gets in and conducts what in my opinion will be a very, very kind of right-wing austerity economic policy, continues to be very pro-war, really won't make any reforms that benefit ordinary people at all. In those circumstances, what have people got left apart from the option of protest? So I think we'll find that there will be resistance. I mean, it's very hard to predict these things. And then there may be a period, you know, there may be some kind of a... I don't know, there may be a short honeymoon period for them, but I don't think it's going to last very long, because I don't think anyone's got massive illusions in the idea that that a Starmer Labour government is going to make much of a difference. Mm.
And where do you think the left is under a Labour government? Well, you know, like if you were to do a health assessment on where the left is right now, and, you know, it's taken a couple of major blows over the last couple of years. A lot of the prominent figures in the Labour Party that represented the left are not there anymore. Where is it? And you know, do you think it's in a place where it's going to grow over the next couple of years, or is it still licking its wounds?
Well, I mean, that's a complex question. I mean, I still think people have... you know, still reeling from the 29 election defeat, which was, you know, very, very serious, because a lot of people had very, very serious hopes that Corbyn was going to win, and that, you know, there could be fundamental change through that avenue. Having said that, I guess that what's happening now, in particular the strike wave last year, but also the Palestine protests now, are beginning to overcome that sense of demoralisation and that sense of despair is a strong word, but I think a lot of people were feeling like that, with a sense of powerlessness. And in particular, that's the case. I mean, partly just because of the scale of the demos. I mean, no one can say now that, you know, people can't mobilise, that demonstrations can't be, mass demonstrations can't be built. And also, no one can say really that, you know, A to B demonstrations don't make a difference. When we have defied a ban, got rid of a toxic foreign secretary, humiliated the far right, put the government on the defensive over this question, you know, these demonstrations have made a difference. So I think that process is starting to take place as well, because funnily enough, you know, one of the two main issues that Corbyn was defeated over was anti-Semitism. And really, that's very much connected to the whole question of Palestine. So we've actually pushed back on the one of the main kind of fronts that the establishment and the government was fighting against us, and felt they probably thought they'd won this. You know, they probably thought they'd managed to marginalise pro-Palestine feeling. They probably thought that, you know, people would be flying the Israeli flag just as they were flying the Ukrainian flag when they, you know, when this war started after the 7th of October. Mm. How wrong they proved to be, that actually what's happened is there's been a huge pushback, there's been a backlash. And part of that backlash, part of the intensity, I believe, of the support for the Palestinians in this country is precisely a kind of revenge for the attacks on Corbyn that were undertaken by the right wing of Labour. So, you know, I think in that sense, any sensible assessment of the situation on the left would be things are looking up, actually, despite the horror of what's going on in Israel. The strike wave was, it was a mixed bag in terms of its outcomes, but it definitely saw a return to collective action in a serious way for the first time in decades. We've now got this huge movement over Palestine, biggest ever movement over Palestine, which is just, you know, keeps coming and coming and coming, is involving huge numbers of people, is winning the battle of ideas in society. Don't forget, 75% of the population agree with us on the question of a ceasefire. Huge numbers of young people getting involved with politics. You know, all of this is incredibly positive, and we need to have a kind of realistic but nevertheless optimistic approach to it. We can build stuff out of this. Now, the exact way that happens, we'll wait and see. You know, maybe we need a new left electoral party. That wouldn't be a bad idea. But most importantly, let's build on the movements. Let's keep people in the streets. Let's try and get to a situation where the unions who were fighting over the cost of living crisis last year now are taking a more serious position on Palestine. Mm. Let's try and get some of the Palestinian activists involved in the movement over the cost of living crisis, if they're not already. Let's try and, you know, interrelate these different movements and build something really strong that can take on the government, both on the domestic questions and on the foreign policy questions. If we got to that point, we'd be in a very good place, really.
Do you think Britain needs a new leftist party at the moment?
I mean, you know, I'd welcome it if it happens. I think it would be a good... it would be a good development, because, you know, I do think you can't, I mean, voting for Labour in general, it's going to be very, very hard. Mm. And, you know, clearly the Starmer leadership doesn't represent the aspirations, even the most modest aspirations of working people in this country. So, yeah, we do need a new electoral party. I think, however, that the left shouldn't make the mistake of thinking that it's all about elections, that politics is just about what happens in Parliament. And what the movement last year, the strike movement and the Palestine movement over the last 3 months has shown to me is, once again, is reaffirmed for me, once again, is the importance of mass protest, the importance of demonstrations, the importance of participatory movements. Because they do a lot. They can shift society. They can make things happen. They can change things in a way that takes years through the parliamentary process. And, you know, I don't think politics should just be about ticking a box on a form once every 4 years and choosing between three or four parties that are often very much in agreement over key issues, that actually politics should be about much more than that. It should be about the streets. It should be about the workplaces. It should be about being in the unions. It should be about campaigning in your community. It should be about actual action and participation in these kind of grassroots movements, because they're the future as far as I'm concerned.
And in terms of the future, and in terms of, you know, you mentioned young people, there was a generation of young people that were really, that came to age during the protest movement against Iraq. There was a similar generation that came to age in 2008, 2009, again, in the caste-led protests. And there is a similar, very, you know, very visible group of young people that are coming of age in the current climate that we're living in. They're asking questions about what's going on. They're asking questions about the positions their governments have taken. And they're coming to these protests in large numbers. My final question to you, Chris, is that going forward, you know, there's been 3 months of these big protests here in London and other cities around the world. Where does it go from here? And how does someone like yourself and other organizers take this momentum and turn it into a mass movement that could solidify around an idea going forward?
Well, I mean, there's a number of aspects to that. We need to keep building the demonstrations. And I think the fact that demonstrations are now beginning to take a kind of coordinated global character is very, very important. And that's something that we should encourage and develop. I think, secondly, we need to diversify the movement. The demonstrations are absolutely key. They're the kind of backbone of the movement. They're the moment when everyone comes together. We feel our strength. We judge the level of mobilization. We put the establishment and the government on the back foot, but they're not enough in themselves. And what we need to do is to make sure that they generate other forms of activity. There's going to be a day of workplace action on the 7th of February where we're asking people in the trade unions, and even if they're not in the unions, to do workplace rallies, to do lunchtime walkouts, to do some level of activity in the workplaces. Also on that day, we're going to be asking students in universities and school students to do walkouts from where they are, or occupations, a day of action that brings together people in the workplaces, working people with students and school students. That's one example. There are lots of other initiatives that are already happening, you know, in terms of protests outside manufacturing industries and manufacturing companies that are sending weapons to Israel, and all sorts of other kinds of direct action, which are important. So I think we do need to diversify the movement. We need to deepen it. We need to get it into every community, every workplace, every educational establishment, so that it's really beginning to mobilise the majority of people who do support us. And once we get to that kind of social weight, and once we diversify and have these different kinds of actions taking place, then we're in a situation where, you know, we can get close to creating a movement that they simply can't ignore. The other sides to it are the political sides. I mean, we've talked a lot about perhaps the need for a political alternative. I think another thing that we're going to announce shortly is a day of lobbying of MPs, where we get people not just to send in an email to their parliamentary representatives, but actually to get down to the surgeries, have a lobby, have a protest, make sure that the maximum pressure is being put on the MPs to listen to the majority, to listen to their constituencies, and to do the decent thing and the humane thing and call for a ceasefire. So that's another aspect to the political campaign. More generally, I would end by saying I think we have to recognise that as we've been discussing, the British establishment's support for Israel is deeply embedded, that it's connected to the wider foreign policy that the Tories and Labour as well, unfortunately, have been pursuing over the last couple of decades, which is essentially an aggressive imperialist policy in the Middle East, in Eastern Europe, over the question of China. So we also need to make sure that the movement, you know, doesn't, you know, while we maximise our pressure, the pressure on what Israel is doing and on our government support for Israel, we also need to understand this movement has got to take on imperialism more generally. It's got to take on the wider aspects of foreign policy and make the connections with the economy and with domestic politics that we were talking about earlier. And, you know, the slogan, welfare, not warfare, that kind of idea is very, very important, because it begins to encapsulate not just a strong argument against militarism and against these horrible foreign policy that that the government's been pursuing, but also about connecting the issues and connecting the question of the cost of living crisis with foreign policy, connecting the economic injustice in this country, the spiralling inequality with the sort of corporate pursuit of corporate policies globally. So I think we also, at the same time as building the movements on the particular issues, we need to start joining the dots more. Mm. And we need to say, you know, we need to build a movement in this country that is really about challenging not just the foreign policy, but also the neoliberal economics that underpin it. And we need to take on both those aspects of the situation. People are fed up with what's going on, you know, in this country. They really are. I mean, rightly, on a whole number of different fronts. You know, the post office scandal, the housing shortage, the state of our services, not just the welfare and the NHS, but the railways and the infrastructure. I mean, this country is in a terrible state, and it's in a terrible state. And people kind of know this because of the kind of governments and the economic and political policies they've been pursuing over the last 25 years. There has to be a change. And the left needs to be quite confidently now saying, we've got to fight tooth and nail to make sure that change happens.
Mm-hmm. Chris Nynam, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
This episode of The Big Picture is produced by me, Mohammed Hassan, for Middle East Eye. Thank you to Hossam Sarhan for filming and Anas Ala for graphics. And thanks to you for listening. If this episode struck a chord with you, or if you disagreed with what was said, we want to hear from you. So you can reach me on Twitter at @MohammedWasHere or by email at mh@middleeasteye.org. You can also watch all of our episodes in video format on our YouTube channel. If you like this, please consider giving us a rating because it goes a long way and helps us reach new audiences. Until next time, salam.